the church program was to raise funds amongst the members to build the buildings, and then actually the buildings themselves were, the biggest percentage of them were built by the members, actual work done. Another thing that was a little different in the church in those days was they had block teachers, and there would be just high priest or priesthood leaders would go out and visit some of the families in the ward, that would, as well as the bishopric and some of the leaders. Then they finally got it to where they would assign all the male members, and they called it ward teaching, and all the priesthood would go. There would be a Melchizedek priesthood holder, and he would take an Aaronic priesthood boy with him, and they still do that to a great degree. They try to involve them as much as they can, and they would go, they were called ward teachers. Then they finally changed that, and then today they call them home teachers, and they have the same combination. Sometimes, however, they will have adults going together, as well as try to use the Aaronic priesthood to go out. And they still try, I think in some wards or a lot of them, they try to have the Aaronic priesthood go to the homes, particularly of those who are semi or inactive, and collect fast offerings on the first Sunday of each month. And that was a big job with us then. Didn't seem like in those days that hardly anybody paid at the church, because the fast offering collection was made at the home, and we in the Aaronic priesthood would go to each of the homes of the members and would have a little envelope that they could put their fast offerings in and sign the envelope and seal it, and then we would take those into to our priesthood leaders. So it's very similar in a lot of ways today. It hasn't changed drastically in that portion of it.
And while we were in Boise, mother was ill quite a bit of the time. She, of course, had five children that lived, five births, and there was one birth that didn't live. So she had gone through six pregnancies, and that's pretty hard. And plus, she had worked real hard. I know on the years when they were on the ranch that she worked hard taking care of everyone, and then she did with us. And as I said, she was always available for us. She was she devoted her life to taking care of Dad and us children, and her health paid. She had, I don't know exactly what the problem was, because I was too young to really understand, but I just know she spent a lot of time in bed. And in order to help cover that situation, Dad hired a lady to come in and do housework and to take care of us kids a lot of times, to help Mother. Her name was Liza Call, and she had her own family, and so I'm sure that that was just an extra job for her. We kind of grew up with her children in a way. They were there a lot of the times when she would come to work. They would come and be there with her, so we played with them a lot, and they were kind of like brothers and sisters to us. The oldest son, Thomas Call, was probably near Maud or Leola's age. Later on in years, he ended up living in in Oakland, California, and was the a president of the Oakland Temple when it opened up in that area. The next son was Francis Call, and he was just a little older than I was, and our lives paralleled later on in years to a degree. While we were younger, both of us played the violin, and unbeknownst to either of the other one, as we got later in life, we both went into the jewelry business. he opened jewelry stores in the Boise area and I in Riverside, California. And even though we would hear about each other every once in a while and we would miss each other at general convention meetings, and so I never did ever get to sit down and talk to him. In fact, one time Jeannie and I, when we were in Boise, we stopped and went to his jewelry store to try to see if we could see him, and his daughter was there running the store, and she says he had gone to Arizona and was opening up a store down in the Phoenix area, so we still missed him that way. The next, there was a girl that was about somewhere near Carlisle, or my age, and her name was Vanita. And then there was a younger boy named Dick. So those kids, we played with them a lot and kind of grew up and were like brothers and sisters to us. One other thing that I did that was interesting when I was there in Boise, I told earlier about going up and swimming on the Boise River up by the dam. On the lower part of the river, as it passed on through town, it spread out into some areas, and there was backwater in some of the fields, and so there were a lot of cattails and marshy land in part of that. And so we fixed up and I can't remember whether we actually used a fishing pole, but anyway, if we didn't have a fishing pole, we used a long willow or stick about the length of a fishing pole, and on the end of it we tied about 16, 18 inches of line, fishing line, and on the end of that we tied a three-gang fishing hook, and then we cut about an inch of red yarn, and we would tie this red yarn just at the top of the hook, and then we would go out to this swampy area, and the water would maybe be 2 feet, at the most 3 feet deep, and we would wade out there. Then we'd go late evening and take a flashlight and go after big bullfrogs. And there would, some real big ones grew in there, and you'd either spot them with the flashlight shining in their eyes, or you'd hear them croaking, and you'd sneak up as close as you could, and then with the fishing pole, you'd reach out and dangle that red yarn in front of them, and sometimes they would jump and grab that, and then you would hook them, and other times why they would just sit there, so you would try to get the three-pronged hook under their chin and hook them that way. And they were many of those frogs that we got like that, they were 5 and 6 inches in size, almost in diameter of size. And of course what we were after was the frog legs, and when I would bring a mess of those home, we would bring the frog legs home to cook them. Why, the minute I would come in the house with them, mother and all the girls would leave. They wouldn't even stay in the house when I was going to cook frog legs. They thought that was so gross and so such a terrible sounding thing that I don't think any of them ever even tried to eat them. But they were very delicious. They taste kind of a little like chicken, maybe a cross between chicken and rabbit as far as taste is concerned, and very tender white meat. And the legs on these that we would get, would sometimes the legs would almost be as big as a drumstick on a chicken, and or like a large wing from a chicken. And I would cook those and really enjoyed them, but it was funny that the girls, none of them would stay around while I was cooking frog legs. When I talked about going out like that to do something like that, all of a sudden it occurs to me that I haven't clarified the transportation situation. When we would go up and swim off the dam on the upper part of the river, it was quite a ways, and sometimes we could bum a ride up there, but when I was 12, I got my first bicycle. That was the first bike I'd ever had. It was a used one, but it was a good bike in good shape, and that gave me the freedom to go just about anywhere I wanted to go, because it was fairly flat country all around the city on the lower part, except up on the bench. And so we could ride the ride our bikes and go just about anywhere we wanted to go. And that many times we'd go up swimming. We'd ride up on our bikes, and then when, especially when we'd go out like this to go out after frogs, we would ride out there on our bikes. Whenever I went hunting with Dad, of course we always went in the car with him, and primarily we hunted pheasants, and that was a great thing to hunt. Pheasants are a beautiful bird, plus they're delicious to eat, and so I always enjoyed the going after the pheasants with Dad as well. I said earlier when I was talking that in 1935 we moved to Brigham City, Utah from Boise. It was in the fall of the year. We had already registered into school and had been in school about a month, I guess, at Boise High School, and we moved. So I changed and started then at Box Elder High School in Brigham City, Utah. Being late in the year, it was a little hard to get started. We went in sometime probably in October, and it was a comparatively small school, and we were able to get any of the classes that we wanted. I remember signing up for the orchestra, and it was a very small orchestra compared to what we had at Boise. And in fact, there were so few instruments involved that the lady who was teaching the orchestra about the second week or so came and asked me if I would consider playing the oboe in the orchestra, because they had quite a few violins, but they didn't have any of the reed instruments. So I said, sure, I would try it. So I played the oboe for a while, and then I also played viola for a while, because they, to try to cover the areas where they didn't have instruments. I could substitute on the viola pretty easily, because all it does is just change to a different clef. It plays out of the tenor clef instead of the treble, and it was easy to improvise that. But the oboe was very hard to play, because the fingering and everything was so different. But I tried it anyway for a while. I also then tried to find a teacher to take violin lessons from, to continue with them there, and the only violin teacher in town was a man by the name of Harold Felt, and he was the mortician. He ran the funeral home in town, in Brigham City, but he taught violin on the side, and so I took a couple of lessons from him, and after about the second lesson, he said, well, you're as advanced as I am on the violin, so there really isn't much I can teach you. So I never did have anyone there to take lessons from. We lived, as I said earlier, we lived in the Barron Apartments, which was an apartment complex that was a very nice place to live. It was very close to the school, so we were within walking distance of the school without any problem. And we lived there the rest of that school year and during the summer. And when it came time for summer, during the year, while we would try to get odd jobs and part-time jobs to supplement so that we'd have a little money, Carlisle got a job delivering a paper route, delivering newspapers, and about the only thing basically that I had as work at that time was just to go into the different orchards and fields and pick fruit or vegetables or whatever what happened to be in season. And I recall just at the beginning of the next summer, when I was in a field picking tomatoes, And I hate tomatoes. I mean, for some reason, I just had no great love for them. And every once in a while, you'd go to pick a tomato that looked good from the top, and it'd be all rotten on the bottom. And so I wasn't very happy with that job. You got paid by how many lugs of or boxes of potatoes you would tomatoes that you would pick, so much a box. And so I had gone all around everywhere I could think of to and put in application for work to see if I couldn't get someone to hire me so that I didn't have to work in the picking fruit and vegetables. And I recall when I was in the field one day picking tomatoes, and Dad drove up to the side of the field and whistled. And I looked up and went on over to where he was standing by the fence, and he said, a man by the name of Taylor wants you to come and work for him over in his service station. And boy, I just jumped the fence and went with him. I didn't even go back and turn in the lug of tomatoes that I had picked. I was so happy to get a job. So I went to work at the service station for 25 cents an hour, which was a real increase for me as far as I thought I was concerned. That was just a real great job, and I enjoyed it. They were nice people. They had their home in the back part of the service station, and they lived there, and he had a wife and either two or three little children, and they were just really nice people, and I worked real hard there at the service station. It was something I really didn't know that much about, the pumping of gas, which was what you did at a service station in those days. You'd go out when the car drive in, and they'd tell you how much gas to put in, and you'd put the gas in, and you'd ask them if you could check the oil, and you'd wash the windshields for them, and you'd check the air and the tires, and they were truly service stations. They weren't like they are today. And so it wasn't too difficult to learn all of those things, but then when it came to changing tires for someone when they come in and repairing the tires, that was a little hard to learn. I had to, Frank taught me how to do that, and he had taught me how to do the passenger car tires, but I'd never had experience of doing a truck tire. And a guy came in one day and had a flat tire on a truck, and we got the wheel off, and I struggled. I couldn't get that tire off the rim. It was just too big and too solid for me. I just didn't have enough weight and enough strength, and he got laughing, and the two of us working together on it, we finally got the tire off and got it patched inside. And you patched the inner tube. You didn't patch the tire like they are today. You patched the inner tube that was inside and put that back and put it back together, and he was real nice about helping me, and he kind of helped me learn how to do a truck tire, because that was a real hard, heavy thing to do. I also worked at the ice cream parlor there in Brigham City for just a short time. Carlisle had worked there also, and I wasn't there very long, but I did work there for a few weeks one time. Another job that I had, I contracted to thin some beets. And the way sugar beets are grown, they plant the seeds in a solid row. And when the plant begins to come up, and they're up maybe a couple of 2 or 3 inches high, then you go along and you thin them. You cut out all of the plants in between, and about every foot you leave one good solid plant. And you can pick which kind of see which is the healthy ones by then and that are doing well. And you leave one at about every 12 inches. The thinning hoe that you use is a 6-inch wide blade and about a 18-inch handle on it. So you're in a bent over position the whole time you're thinning. And you can't kneel down because you have to keep moving. So you're bent from the waist, and you find a good plant, and then you cut out the ones in between and leave this space, and you just walk down these rows, row after row, of the beets like that, thinning them. Well, I had worked for some of the guys out in the area. They generally grew the beets out around Bear River and Tree Mountain and out in that area. And so I found that there was a guy who had 8 acres of beets, and he wanted to contract and have somebody do the 8 acres. So I contracted to thin the 8 acres for $10 an acre, and did all 8 acres of those beets for that $80. And I was, you know, that was hard work, but $80 was sure big money. And I thought I really came out real well on that one. But I don't know that I've ever worked any harder in my life for anything than I did for that. The area of Brigham City has beautiful area during the summer, and they grow a lot of fruit, a lot of cherries, a lot of peaches. And in fact, Brigham City is known as the peach city in the area because of the amount of peaches that they grow. And so after we'd been there about a year, the folks moved over on 4th Street and rented a house. Instead of it being in the apartment, they rented a house, and it was on about 4 acres of ground, I think. I'm not sure of the acreage, but anyway, there was a pretty good sized peach orchard on this by this house. So Dad allowed me to take over on the peaches, and said if I would take care of them and water them and thin them, which you do on peaches when the first peaches come on and they're only about the size of a large marble, well, you go through and you take a lot of them off the tree, where they're, especially when they're growing right against each other, you take one away so that as the peaches grow, they're not stunted and they will grow larger and you have much nicer fruit. So to irrigate and to fertilize and to thin and to take and then to pick the peaches, he said I could have whatever I could generate in money off those peaches if I took care of them. Well, it wasn't a job that required every day, all day, so I was able to do other things, especially to work over in the service station some of the time. But I did make pretty good off of those peaches by working them. It was interesting to me that happened. The water, when you would water the orchard, the water came in on water rights, and there would be certain times that you could then open up and take water from the big irrigation canal and run it in to water your trees. And they would tell you the certain times that this would happen, and sometimes that occurred in the middle of the night, like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, that would be the time when you would run the water in. So there were times, a lot of times, when I would be out opening the floodgates and seeing that the water went down the rows and watered the trees good, and worked during the night doing that. So it was an interesting thing for me to do, to learn about how to take care of the peach orchard. The winter time, there would a lot of times a lot of snow, and it would get very cold there. And the one winter, I don't know whether it was the first one we were there or the second one, but my brother and I borrowed Dad's car and went out for an evening, and we found that there was one street where the road plows had plowed the street, and it just made it real smooth and hard, almost like a ski slope. And then they had piled the snow in big piles on both sides of the road, so that made the road almost like a tunnel. So we would get going down the road in the car and slam on the brakes and cramp the wheel, and the car would just go down this ski area down the road, just turning round and round and round, and when we'd finally stop, we'd just stop up against a snowbank. I doubt if Dad ever knew that that's the way we used the car some of the nights when we were out playing around as teenagers. During the year that I was 16 years old, during the winter months while I was in school, I also got a job at J.C. Penney's. I started as just a stock boy type of situation, unloading the boxes in the basement and putting the clothing on racks and taking them upstairs. And then I advanced to where I could work on the floor as a salesperson. And I guess that was my first exposure to selling, and I really enjoyed it. I guess one of the big differences was that when you're working in the fields, you're pretty grubby. And when you're working at a service station, you're pretty grubby. And when I went to work in the men's clothing department at Penney's selling clothing, I had to dress pretty nice. And I remember that was the first suit I ever remember owning after I was a teenager, and Dad bought me a new suit so that I could look presentable to sell. The suit that I picked out was probably a little louder, a little more extra fashion type of situation, but Dad picked a very conservative gray suit and said that if I was going to make a presentation to sell, that's the way I should look. And he was probably right, because I found that all through the years and later in selling that you wanted to be pretty conservative, because you wanted the person that you were trying to sell something to, that you wanted them to look at the product, not at the way you looked. And it was interesting when I was working there for Penney's to learn about the product. I had to learn about the different kinds of materials and the different cloth and the different patterns and the different ways to put shirt and tie together to match and clothing together. And it was real interesting. I enjoyed working there. I worked there after schools and Saturdays most of that year when I was 16 years old. Also, when I was 16, I was a sophomore in high school, and the girl that I went out with most of the time, that we had a real good friendship and went to the dances and dated quite a bit together, was the bishop's daughter, and she was a senior. She was older than I was, but we really enjoyed each other, and her name was Nida Anderson, and we went together almost that whole school year when I was a sophomore. Then she graduated and went on to school or somewhere else, I guess, and we moved by the next year, so I never did follow up or see much of her again for a long time. And one time when Jeannie and I we were in an airport in San Francisco going somewhere, and we met Nida and her husband accidentally, and visited with them for a few minutes before they got on a plane and we got on a plane, and that was the only time I ever saw her again after we left Brigham City. I mentioned, too, also that Carnall had had paper routes, and we had delivered papers. And one of the things that happened, he would get real tired because he had to get up so early to take those papers. And so sometimes in the night, he would kind of walk in his sleep and talk in his sleep. And if I wanted to know anything, I would just ask him questions when I'd hear him talk, and he'd answer anything I wanted to know, and the next day he wouldn't remember anything about it. And one night I'd been out, and he went to bed early. I was out somewhere, and I came home, and in the meantime he got up and started walking in his sleep, and he rearranged all the furniture in the room. No rhyme or reason to why he did it, but he moved things around, and he put a he put the dresser right over in front of the door. So I came in, and I wanted to come in quietly, not to disturb him, so I didn't turn on the light, and I kicked that dresser and broke a toe, and he reminds me of that every once in a while still, that I still have a broken toe to remember of the times when we lived there in Brigham up in the Barron Apartments. I guess I'm going to talk a little more about the Boise area. When we were living in Boise, we used to go visit grandparents about once a year, probably no oftener than that. Grandpa and Grandpa Green had moved to Buell, Idaho, and Grandpa Walker was still living in Louisville. And we would get over there to visit very seldom because distance was really a problem, we living in Boise. But one of Dad's brothers, Uncle Lester, and Aunt Vic, moved to Nampa, which was only about 30 miles away from Boise. I think Uncle Lester got a job with Metropolitan Life, the same company that Dad was with. I think Dad was influential in getting him started in that. So we were quite well acquainted with our cousins in that family. They